Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control, and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor, and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries, and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I done signed and I done stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So like, you could just see $600,000
deducted.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man. Let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, I said, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government, plus I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the dough. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the dough? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go over on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week. 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarion. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarion took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarion, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Coffee and Ethiopia are so related. Some people say it's a way of showing love to one another. While I was growing up too, we see coffee as socializing between neighbors, living in the neighborhood. They gather around coffee to have a cup of coffee. Usually they don't have one cup, they have three cups.
Ethiopia and coffee are intertwined. The country prides itself as being the birthplace of coffee, roughly discovered in the 9th century. The coffee origin story strongly influenced the culture, traditions, and methods of how coffee is made throughout the country.
There is a common legend which everybody knows about the goat herder who found out that his goats were acting differently from before. He was herding his goats in the Kaffa Mountains, so he followed them what they were eating to be so active and so hyper. He found out that they were having reddish berries, and once they tasted that, they became so energetic and they jump around. At that time, there was a monastery nearby. So he went with the berry, tell them what happened. The abbot at first wasn't excited, so he threw it in the fire. They roasted it unintentionally. He saw the aroma of the smell of the coffee. He had to try it. So they washed it, and so they tried it. That's why we started the coffee.
Originally, it's traditional coffee in Ethiopia. Now things started changing. We go to machine coffee. I think now I prefer machine coffee than traditional coffee. I think because it comes fast. Traditional coffee needs processing. It needs minimum of one hour, 1.5 hours. When you come to machine coffee, you do it in 15 minutes.
When they prepare the coffee traditionally, they have the small pots, the small glasses.
These are called sini, and it's like pretty much a traditional cup that is used in Ethiopia when having coffee ceremony or drinking coffee. We have popcorn, which is also a popular snack while having the ceremony. This is called tat, which is grass. And when you're having a grand celebration like this, you have it all over your house, and it just brightens it up. And this is ambasha. It's a type of bread that is made in Ethiopia. It's really good. It's also another popular snack. And this is bunna, which is coffee. I'm roasting it right now.
The next few steps entail manually grinding the coffee and then scooping the grinded coffee into a clay pot called a jibena. The whole process takes a few hours to complete, leaving plenty of time to socialize. Once done, 3 rounds of coffee is distributed to each guest.
They drink the first cup, it's called Abol. It's very strong. It has a lot of ground coffee. And the second, they put water in it. It's called Tona. And they put water. For the third time, it's called Baraka. That's how we came for the dark roast, medium roast, light roast. The first shop of coffee shops was opened in Italy. They came up with the machines. They brought it to Addis. We are the source of coffee. They have the demand of coffee. We cannot serve forever in the pots in the traditional way. Yes, it's good. We have to find a quicker way. And here we are.
Established in 1953, this coffee shop is part of the first coffee roasting company in Ethiopia.
Since the opening of the shop, we have machinery who dates back to the starting of this business. So we only use authentic, old machinery. We had to find a way to serve them quickly and efficiently. They had to taste that good Ethiopian coffee. So we had to bring the Italian machines along to spice our flavorsome coffee.
Italian machine coffee rapidly changed the pace of how coffee is made in Ethiopia. In the streets of Addis Ababa, you are full for choice when looking for a quality cup of coffee. The smell radiates in the air, the beans flow in their bloodstream. It's more than just a drink, it's part of who they are.
Did you know that Brazil has been the world's largest coffee producer for over 150 years? In this video, we will look at the history of coffee in Brazil. We will touch on its early days under Portuguese influence, the scars left by slavery, and the diversity brought by Japanese immigrants and others who toiled on its plantations. We will discuss the era of the coffee barons and how their legacy is etched into the fabric of today's industry. Our journey will reveal how coffee became a cultural icon and an economic powerhouse in Brazil. Legend has it that the Portuguese, eager to partake in the burgeoning coffee trade, were thwarted by the refusal of French Guiana's governor to export the precious seeds. In a twist of fate, Francisco de Melo Paleta, a Portuguese lieutenant colonel, was commissioned to French Guiana to mediate a territorial conflict. It was during this diplomatic endeavor that Paleta ingeniously secured coffee seeds, which he subsequently introduced to Brazil. The narrative goes that after a diplomatic assembly in 1727, the governor's wife of French Guiana, charmed by Paleta, discreetly presented him with a bouquet laced with coffee seeds. This covert exchange was motivated by Portugal's strategic ambition to cultivate a commodity that was rapidly reshaping international commerce. Understanding that Brazil's climate and terrain were ideal for coffee cultivation, the Portuguese foresaw the opportunity to dominate a burgeoning market. They were keenly aware of coffee's growing popularity in Europe, where it was becoming a staple in social settings like coffee houses, and was increasingly in demand by the burgeoning middle class. By introducing coffee to Brazil, the Portuguese aimed to replicate the agricultural success seen on other colonial plantations, and to secure a foothold in the profitable coffee trade. This move would eventually turn Brazil into a coffee powerhouse, profoundly shaping its economy and society in the centuries to follow. The growth of these plantations coincided with the decline of sugar's dominance in Brazilian exports. Coffee began to fill the vacuum, offering plantation owners a high-profit alternative. However, this economic opportunity brought with it a reliance on slave labor. Enslaved Africans were brought to Brazil in large numbers to provide the labor needed to plant, maintain, and harvest the coffee crops. Their expertise in agriculture and their forced labor were pivotal in establishing Brazil's coffee industry during these early years. The conditions on the coffee plantations were brutal. Enslaved workers faced long hours, hard work, and severe punishments. Despite the harshness of their circumstances, the knowledge and skills of these workers were essential to the success of the plantations. They knew the land, understood the seasons, and implemented cultivation techniques that maximized yield. By the mid-19th century, coffee had become the economic backbone of Brazil, with the country becoming the prime coffee supplier to a caffeine-hungry world. The wealth generated by the coffee industry began to alter the social and political landscape of Brazil, giving rise to a class of coffee barons who wielded significant influence and power. These barons would invest in infrastructure, such as railroads, to transport coffee beans to ports, which in turn facilitated the growth of urban centers. It's important to note that this growth was not sustainable without significant social and environmental costs. The demand for more land for coffee plantations led to deforestation and other environmental changes, while the social structure was heavily stratified.
With nearly 30,000 cafes across the globe, Starbucks has become more than just a household name. From its iconic cups, often adorned with misspelled names, to the espresso inside them, Starbucks has catapulted from one coffee bean shop in Seattle to a sprawling $80 billion business over the last 47 years. Starbucks sales account for 57% of the total cafe market. Yes, 57%. Nearly two-thirds of all coffee sold at cafes in the U.S. comes from a Starbucks. But this impressive expansion hasn't come without growing pains. With more than 14,000 locations in the U.S. alone, Starbucks has spread itself too thin. Having too many stores has led to fewer transactions at individual stores. To compensate, the company has raised prices. But doing this too quickly or too often can drive customers away. So how did this happen? And what's a coffee giant to do about it? The year is 1970. Three college friends, Zev Siegel, Jerry Baldwin, and Gordon Boker, decide to get into the coffee business. They found a mentor in Alfred Peet, founder of Peet's Coffee, and the man responsible for bringing custom coffee roasting to the U.S.
He knew the coffee industry inside and out, especially the gourmet end. He was the most educated coffee guy in the country at that time.
So with Peet's help, the three friends opened Starbucks, a coffee bean shop and roastery at Seattle's famous Pike Place Market in 1971. Peet provided the young entrepreneurs with roasted coffee beans and connected them with coffee brokers until they could set up their own roastery and source their own beans. For the first decade, the founders opened five more locations in Seattle. At this point, contemporary coffee consumers might have noticed a glaring absence, actual coffee drinks. But that's the thing about the 70s coffee culture. It didn't really exist outside the home.
There were no coffee bars, nor was there much of a demand for espresso-based drinks. You purchased coffee beans, and you either took them home as beans, or we ground them for you in the store. Nobody expected to get a beverage at a Starbucks coffee store until after 1980.
Starbucks' initial focus was bringing high-quality beans to consumers who were more accustomed to instant or canned coffee. But that changed with the addition of one man.
The company hired its first really professional director of marketing and sales. And that man was Howard Schultz. And he couldn't figure out why we weren't selling beverages.
In 1983, Schultz travels to Italy and returns with an idea. Turn the coffee bean stores into cafes. Starbucks served its first latte the next year. The experiment was a success. And 4 years later, Schultz partnered with investors and bought Starbucks for $3.8 million. He was only 34 at the time. Schultz pursued a strategy of aggressive expansion. By the time the company went public in 1992, it had 165 stores. By 1996, it had opened more than 1,000 locations, including its first international cafes in Japan and Singapore. Growth was so rapid that just 3 years later, Starbucks opened its 2,000th location.
Once they found a business model that worked, that translated to other geographies, that gave them the opportunity to really accelerate growth, really put the pedal to the metal in terms of expanding across the globe.
Schultz switched from CEO to executive chairman in 2000, at which time Starbucks operated 3,500 stores in more than a dozen countries. Between 2000 and 2007, the number of Starbucks cafes more than quadrupled, from 3,500 to over 15,000. During this period, the company opened an average of 1,500 stores every year, including 2,500 in 2007 alone. Sales shot up from $2 billion to $9.4 billion. Consumers were increasingly ditching their kitchen mugs for these iconic paper-to-go cups. But then Starbucks hit a wall. 2007 financial crash. That year, its rapid growth screeched to a halt, and its stock price plummeted by 50% as cash-strapped consumers backed away from pricey coffee habits.
The Great Recession was devastating for the restaurant industry. What we typically saw was more trading out, so consumers taking a pause on that everyday luxury that Starbucks offered.
So Starbucks brought back Howard Schultz. This news alone caused Starbucks stock to shoot up by 9%. Schultz halted growth and focused on customer experience. He shuttered cafes, more than 600 in 2008 and another 300 in 2009, and laid off around 6,700 baristas. A month after his return, Schultz ordered Starbucks to close all of its U.S. locations for one afternoon so he could retrain more than 135,000 baristas about how to make its signature espresso. Schultz's goal was to remind customers what they loved about the brand by making the stores an experience, not just a place to get a quick coffee. They stopped selling breakfast sandwiches and brought back in-house grinding, infusing the cafes once again with that fresh coffee aroma. Schultz even mandated the removal of automatic espresso machines. These made service faster but removed much of the romance and theater of watching baristas craft each cup of coffee. Schultz's makeover worked. The company's stock soared more than 143% in 2009, and same-store sales rebounded. Starbucks has posted positive same-store sales ever since. During Schultz's makeover of the cafes, Starbucks barely opened any new stores, but the pace picked up again in 2012. By 2017, Starbucks opened nearly 3,000 more locations, ending the year with 28,000 cafes around the world. However, this brings us back to the first problem, profit cannibalization. Oversaturation, particularly in urban locations, has spread sales thin. Because Starbucks has so many locations, customers don't have to be loyal to just one. So even if Starbucks' overall sales are growing, its individual same-store sales won't reflect it. Compounding this problem are changing consumer preferences. People are shying away from sugar-laden calorie bombs, which happens to be one of Starbucks' staples. These signature frappuccinos contain an average of 57 grams of sugar. That's more than double the recommended daily limit of sugar. So to combat these problems, Starbucks is changing once again. The company announced the closure of 150 stores in 2019. That may seem like a drop in the bucket for a sprawling company like Starbucks, but it's three times the number of stores it usually closes each year. The company will still open stores, but future growth will be more focused. Additionally, decadent drinks topped with whipped cream are taking a back seat. Instead, the company is pushing lighter drinks like cold brew and its fruity refreshers. The company also plans to roll out delivery to a quarter of its company-owned stores by the middle of 2019. Perhaps the company's biggest undertaking is its new line of upscale stores, Starbucks Reserve Roasteries. These massive 20,000 square foot stores are designed to be a tourist destination. Here, Starbucks baristas and bartenders experiment with different brewing methods and craft new, innovative beverages. These have proven popular. In the first week, the Shanghai Roastery made an average of $64,000 every day, which is double what a regular cafe makes in a week. The company has opened four roasteries so far with plans for two more.
It doesn't look and feel like anything else that Starbucks has. Those are the kind of experiential stores, the high-end experience stores that consumers are really looking for. But I think what's going to be more interesting coming out of that is the halo effect that puts the brand in a higher light among consumers. Yeah, that's pretty meaningful.
All right, today we're going through the history of coffee, also known as liquid love. We'll open up the phone lines right after the history of coffee.
Coffee. Over 125 million people today are, in some form, employed in the industry surrounding it worldwide, helping to bring the world the 400 billion cups of coffee it consumes each year. Many, in fact, consider having at least a morning cup of coffee a necessary part of having a productive day, or at least a stable one. The main reason for this, unless you're drinking decaf, is the famous, invigorating, and generally safe drug called caffeine. Coffee has helped to fuel mankind and its various pursuits for centuries, but how long, exactly? Where did coffee come from, and how did it take over the world? Ladies and gentlemen, hello and welcome to Fire of Learning. I'm Justin. In this video, we will be exploring the fascinating origins of coffee. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Lamia Bukris, Eric Rader, Beth Baird, Mike Fantasia, Stephen Colonna, Michael McGinnis, Nicola Lonechar, Everett White, Anubis Anarchy, Faceless Buster, David M.D., Lene Casperson, Blaine Arahara, Carolis, and Alan Hasty for being our most recent supporters on Patreon. They join these supporters who help make these videos possible. Also, a past patron had his name mispronounced. Jacob Sewers is actually Jacob Sievers. This video is an improved remake of a video I did years ago. Now then, let's get to it. Many societies, such as the United States, home to many of the world's most famous coffee house chains, consider coffee to be a central part of their dietary culture. However, though caffeine itself has been consumed by humans in some form since before recorded history, for most of human history, coffee itself was unknown to the world. The story begins in the late Middle Ages and early modern era, with the berries of a small tree native to Oromia, a region of what is today the East African nation of Ethiopia. This is the homeland of the kaffiyeh plant. When exactly people first stumbled upon and consumed the berries of the kaffiyeh plant and felt the stimulating effects of the red berries or cherries is not known. One legend attributes the discovery to an Ethiopian goat herder named Kaldi, who lived sometime between the 6th and 9th century. One day, he noticed some of his goats had become quite energetic after chewing on the red berries of an unfamiliar shrub. Made curious by his dancing goats, he tried the berries for himself and felt these energizing effects. Believing his discovery to be quite important, he took the berries to a local monk. The monk, however, rejected them and cast them into a nearby fire. However, the smell of the roasting coffee seeds within the berries, which are usually called beans, although they're technically not, caught his attention, as well as the attention of other nearby monks. The beans were taken from the fire, ground up, and mixed into a cup of water. Thus, the first cup of coffee. This story, which seems to come from European writers from the late 1600s, is probably much more legend than history. One of a handful of legends pertaining to the discovery of coffee, in fact. No one knows who first discovered the effects of coffee, and we likely never will. However, it is certainly quite possible that the true story is not too dissimilar. Caffeine is a deadly poison to insects. It's believed that caffeine naturally functioned as a pesticide, overloading the nervous system of insects, causing them to die before they could consume a large portion of the plant. However, that same effect on a much larger creature, like a human or perhaps a goat, is a much more survivable and enjoyable experience. One way or another, Ethiopian locals, likely the Gala tribe, discovered this effect of the coffee berry. However, it does not appear that they were the first to make a drink from the seeds. Rather, that appears to have happened in the nearby Islamic world. Like in Africa, it appears that the Arabs first chewed the beans and made drinks from them, which historians believe were quite different from modern coffee. This may have begun sometime around the 10th century or so. The Persian scholar Al-Razi seems to have mentioned the stimulating effects of the berries around this time. The Arabs called the drink they made from the berries kabwa, a word interestingly related to their word for wine and likely the origin of the modern word for coffee across most languages. When they began making coffee in its modern form is not known, but it seems to have been sometime between the 10th and 15th century. There is clear, written evidence of the consumption of coffee in the Islamic world by at least the 15th century, a drink which they again gave the same name as the other drink, kabwa. According to Bennett Allen Weinberg and Bonnie K. Beeler in The World of Caffeine, the earliest certain appearance of coffee in its modern form comes from the mid-15th century, in the monasteries of Sufi monks in Yemen, which was just across the Red Sea. They also note there is a strange lack of discussion about coffee beans or potentially coffee itself, the beans being called boon or boonsham, between the 10th and 15th centuries, with the exception of folk accounts, such as that of the Sheikh Omar. His story is another one pertaining to the supposed discovery of coffee. He is said to have survived off the berries and the drink he brewed from them after having been banished, and introduced them to his people in the 12th century. Why this 500-year gap regarding the discussion of coffee exists is yet another coffee mystery. Anyway, it appears to have reached the city of Mocha in modern-day Yemen by that time. It soon reached nearby Mecca. From there, Mecca being a Mecca of the Islamic world after all, it spread out across the Middle East and North Africa. Interestingly, coffee initially had a religious significance to many Muslims, especially the Sufis, who used it to assist in fasting during Ramadan, as well as to aid them in staying awake at night for prayers. It was also believed to have carried many medicinal benefits, some of which, though not all of course, scientists today know consuming it really does have. Quite quickly, though, in a society which forbade alcohol, it became a drink of the common people for normal, casual use. What followed were places for men, men of all classes, but men only, to congregate and consume the beverage. These were the first coffee houses. Women could consume coffee at home, though in some circumstances they were allowed to sing at coffee houses, provided they were hidden from view. These coffee houses became places of both relaxation and games, but also serious discussion and argument. Not everyone approved, however. Other Muslims felt that the ban on intoxicants, such as alcohol, mentioned in the Quran, should apply to coffee as well. Furthermore, coffee houses became sources of trouble, centers of debauchery forbidden by Islamic law, and hotbeds of political unrest. Indeed, at certain points and in certain places, such as the city of Mecca in 1511, coffee and coffee house bans were enacted, forcing the trade and consumption underground. In some cases, trading and consuming coffee was punishable by death. The spread to the Christian world seems to have come via the burgeoning Ottoman Empire, which ruled over parts of Europe and much of the Middle East. The Ottomans conquered Yemen in 1536. Syrians introduced coffee to the capital of Constantinople in the 1550s, and the Turks became very enthusiastic about it. Many European merchants and travelers first observed it there, tried it on some occasions, and sometimes wrote of it. Coffee's gradual introduction to Europe appears to have been through both war and trade. In 1565, the Ottomans attempted to conquer the island of Malta. They were defeated, however, by the Knights of St. John. They took Ottoman soldiers as slaves, who introduced the Maltese to coffee. Decades later, the Venetians became interested in the drink and acquired it through trade, becoming the first to introduce the drink to the continent. Throughout the late 1500s, coffee quickly spread to many other parts of Europe. England, France, the other Italians, and the Dutch were especially interested. The people of Europe began to search for the plant which produced these wonderful new beans. The Dutch were the first to succeed in 1616 when a sly merchant, Peter van der Brugge, acquired them while in the city of Mocha. This was no simple task. The Yemenis guarded their coffee supply closely, requiring that any beans which left the area be boiled or roasted to prevent germination. However, Peter was not the first to succeed in smuggling them. A Muslim pilgrim had already succeeded in bringing them to India by taping the seeds to his stomach under his clothes. Still, Brugge's success was of great importance to his people. He took them back to his home in the Netherlands, where he began to successfully grow them. However, such cold climates as Northern Europe are not ideal for large-scale coffee production. Thankfully for the Dutch, however, in this time they were in the business of acquiring tropical colonies, such as the island of Sri Lanka, south of India, the island of Java in Indonesia, and Suriname in South America. The Dutch East India Company spearheaded European coffee production in these areas in the late 16 and early 1700s, fueling Europe's new coffee addiction for many years. Other European empires would follow suit in their warmer colonies as well. In 1720, Gabriel de Cleux brought coffee to the island of Martinique. Legend says he introduced it to the island and kept it alive on his ship by sharing his limited water ration with it, though in truth others may have already brought it there. Much of the coffee drank around the world, Arabica, is said to be descended from his plants. Arabica, by the way, is one of the four main varieties of coffee drank around the world to this day, accounting for about 65% of production, the other main one being Robusta, which makes up much of the remainder. Liberica and Excelsa are somewhat rarer. Anyway, coffee was also farmed by the slaves of the French colony of Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti, which would later begin to produce massive amounts of coffee as well. The first European coffee houses opened in Venice in 1645. The rest of Europe followed suit, with thousands of coffee houses springing up throughout the continent in the subsequent decades. European coffee houses were not quite as rowdy as the Middle Eastern counterparts, as they already had pubs with alcohol for that. Thus, they were more likely to become centers of intellectual culture. However, that does not mean they were not centers of trouble at all. Coffee houses were frequent meeting places for those seeking to discuss new ideas which often contradicted the ideas of ruling political elites. In 1675, Charles II, the son of a king who had had his head cut off by political dissidents after a civil war, attempted to shut down coffee houses throughout England, but retracted his order when the public outcry was too great. Likewise, French Enlightenment philosophers were later known for gathering in coffee houses in the years prior to the French Revolution. Coffee wasn't always popular with those supportive of the Enlightenment, however. In his book, Uncommon Grounds, Mark Pendergast shares a quote from Frederick the Great, the 18th century king of Prussia, and, by the way, friend of the enthusiastic coffee addict Voltaire, in which he denounced it. He was recorded to have said, "It is disgusting to notice the increase in the quantity of coffee used by my subjects, and the like amount of money that goes out of the country in consequence. My people must drink beer. His Majesty was brought up on beer, and so were his ancestors." End quote. He then banned the roasting of coffee outside of government establishments for 4 years. Old Fritz was known for being a bit of a curmudgeon. In Frederick's defense, importing coffee to Prussia was costly. Others, however, believed that coffee had helped to bring sobriety to their countries and were glad to see the change. Like in the Islamic world, Christians initially also had religious concerns about coffee. Though their concerns were not as strong, they did have concerns about a Muslim drink becoming popular among their people. However, when Pope Clement VIII tried it around the year 1600, he gave it his blessing. It is claimed, and it may or not be true, that he said, quote, "Why, this Satan's drink is so delicious that it would be a pity to let the infidels have exclusive use of it. We shall cheat Satan by baptizing it and making it a truly Christian beverage," end quote. And thus, the Catholic world, especially Italy and eventually France, accepted coffee and never looked back. The Italians in particular would become creative with coffee, inventing many ways of having it, including espresso. In Victorian England, Christian prohibitionists encouraged coffee houses as an alternative to alcohol. A few branches of Christianity, however, eventually did decide against coffee, most famously the Mormons. In 1683, a massive Ottoman army attempted to conquer the Austrian capital of Vienna. At the Battle of Vienna, they were defeated by a combined Christian force who, upon pillaging the Ottoman army camps, found coffee. Initially, they assumed it was camel food, so they burned it. But thankfully for them, a commander who had lived in the Ottoman Empire for a time recognized the smell. This helped coffee's immediate spread throughout Central and Eastern Europe. Coffee was very well received throughout Europe. However, throughout this time, it should be remembered that coffee was in competition with tea, for which the British, for example, developed preference. This was the case in their American colonies as well. That is, of course, until the Tea Act was placed upon them. After American patriots held the Boston Tea Party in 1773, tea became a symbol of royal tyranny, and Americans began to prefer coffee, which they still do to this day, though it was expensive and less common in America in those days. For example, in 1774, John Adams wrote to his wife Abigail saying, quote, "Tea must be universally renounced, and I must be weaned. The sooner the better." Caffeine was first separated from coffee by Friedrich Ferdinand Runge in 1819 at the suggestion of Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Coffee only reached isolationistic Japan in 1858. In the end, the king of coffee plantations would be Brazil. Coffee became popular there after the country gained independence from Portugal in 1822. By 1852, Brazil was leading the world in terms of coffee production. Much of this was through slave labor. In fact, coffee production played a large role in making Brazil the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery, not doing so until 1888, and only then in part because paid labor from Europe became cheaper. To this day, the large, warm, and fertile country of Brazil remains the world's largest coffee producer. From 1850 until 1950, in fact, it exported more coffee than the rest of the world combined. Since then, other countries, namely Vietnam, Colombia, Indonesia, and of course Ethiopia, have begun to increase production. Each of these countries lies between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, or what's called the Coffee Belt, a geographical belt stretching around the planet where conditions are ideal for growing coffee. Today, Brazil produces one-third of all the world's coffee. In the industrial era, when coffee production became more bountiful, coffee began to move from being a drink more often than not associated with the upper classes to one which fueled working people in their gruesome labor conditions. To this day, common folk fuel their labor across a wide variety of fields with coffee. Though, as I mentioned, Brazil produces coffee at great levels, proportionally speaking, Finland drinks more coffee than any other country at over 26 pounds per capita per year. The rest of Scandinavia has high consumption levels as well, if you consider Finland Scandinavia. Anyway, Of the American states, New York is the most interested in coffee. Today, coffee's popularity is stronger than ever, and it doesn't appear likely that that popularity is going anywhere. With so many people consuming so much coffee, many wonder, how exactly is coffee affecting our health? Coffee has been viewed as a drug since its beginnings. Indeed, in its early days, it was perhaps viewed more as a drug than as a comestible. In its early days, it was said to cause impotence, sterility, exhaustion, dry up cerebrospinal fluid, and eventually cause paralysis. Inversely, others said that it was a remedy for plague, and that it prevented stillbirths. These claims weren't exactly scientific, but modern science has shown that there are a number of benefits and drawbacks to coffee, some of which were indeed suggested by the people of the past. Overall, coffee is considered very safe when consumed at normal amounts, i.e., on average, 3 to 4 cups a day. Each cup of normal coffee contains about 95 milligrams of caffeine, almost 4 times the amount in a cup of tea. We all know people who would call that rookie numbers, though. That amount may be too high for pregnant women. Coffee intake may be associated with low birth rate or even miscarriage, but the science on this is not very clear. Overall, coffee may be more beneficial to human health than harmful. Many studies show coffee drinkers seem to live longer than non-drinkers and are at lower risk for a whole list of diseases. Whether or not this is causal, that is to say whether or not coffee itself is actually causing people to live longer and be healthier, or if it's co-correlated with something else, is unclear. Coffee may also improve gastrointestinal health, lift mood, and, as many are well aware, give an individual a feeling of increased energy. Still, coffee is not very nutritional in itself, and it can have negative effects, especially when consumed in excess or consumed by individuals suffering from disorders such as GERD, an anxiety disorder, or, much more seriously, an unruptured aneurysm. In case you were wondering, on average it would take about 70 cups of coffee, or over 4 gallons, at once to kill a healthy adult, though you would likely begin feeling extremely unpleasant before even nearing that number, and find yourself unable to go through with it. In fact, you would likely die from water intoxication well before caffeine overdose. More concentrated forms of caffeine have been deadly, however, so be careful about combining coffee with other, stronger sources of caffeine. I hope you enjoyed this video. If so, I invite you to come check out the rest of Fire of Learning and to subscribe for more videos like this in the future. To help with the cost of producing these videos, a donation on Patreon would be a big help. A special thanks to our patrons once again listed here. We are also on Instagram, and I run a science channel called Lucinox, which you may want to check out too. Sources are listed in the description. History of Spain Part 2 is coming. Thank you for watching. All right, well, I'm going to go grab a cup of tea.
All right, we're this month, for the rest of this month, we're going to feature, in addition to our regular housing stuff, the history of food. History of food. So we started off with, from an African-American point of view, Black History Month point of view, coffee, and there's a lot of history to coffee. At the end of that last audio, I remember I was with Norfolk, Virginia, and I was with a friend of mine, so we're at a pancake house. So I don't know why I did this, but I drank a whole pot of coffee, and it was, I'm sure, not decaf'd. I didn't think about that at the time. But, man, about an hour or so later, boom, I had to go to the hospital. I won't do that again. I'm more cream and sugar than coffee. That's me. Anyway, Delmar, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, any comment, Delmar, on the coffee?
I don't comment.
There's a lot more to the history. I only played a little bit of it.
That verge of the history is typical European story where you just leave the blacks out. I just don't appreciate that at all. In order to get the black part of anything, you got to go to a black author who has to research and find out what they purposely leave out of it. The story of Ethiopia and the coffee is much more detailed than just the European version, because, again, they're going to talk about everybody but the black folks. If you go dig deeper and look for the black history of coffee, you're going to find a lot more and find that black people, even the slaves, but people before slaves, had a greater influence on the marketing and the growing of coffee than you're going to get from the standard European point of view. Because, again, just like everything, they're going to leave us out, and they'll bring it up. And one that we talked about, black history in America has just been left untouched. It's still there, but they're not going to bring it out. We have to bring it out. We have to say this is, and what I found when you go to the YouTube and print up the black history of coffee, and then you get the information. If you just go to the history of coffee, they're going to leave it out. They're going to leave it out as they leave without a lot of things. And so that's my view on that part of it.
Well, you're correct. I'm reading here now. Ethiopia, now I'm reading this word for word. This is not my words. It says, Ethiopia, which is in East Africa, is widely considered to be the epicenter of where coffee came from. If you've ever Googled coffee history, you'll have come across the famous story of how coffee was founded in Ethiopia by Kaldi, that's K-A-L-D-I, an Ethiopian goat herder around 800 A.D. Let me look that up. But it's got a deep history to it. Go on, I'm listening.
Well, when he said goat herder, that doesn't say the man was black. Again, you leave it out. The central part that these were Ethiopians and not white folks. They're not Europeans. And you have to say that sometimes. People just skip right over that, that role. And this goat herder, again, the culture they lived in and the farming and using what they found is more natural to them than some stranger who would look at something, wouldn't know what it is, wouldn't pay any attention. But this guy was observant enough to see that something is causing my goat to act different. And that's an intelligent approach. That wasn't ignorance. He investigated and found out and followed up on it and said, there's something in this being that makes beings react to it. And so that's worth noting to me, that this man had that kind of tenderness to follow up on what was happening from what. And so, and then the rest of it, of course, involved, and of course, the other part that involved, again, one I read stated that coffee had been not stolen, actually taken from the African context, would have been a generational wealth for that country. But as you know, the merchant came in and took power, and when coffee was marketed to that part of the world, they didn't give the African credit for what they're getting. Of course, that's standard history. Yes, Ethiopia is the birthplace, but that's played down. Like nobody said that Chicago was founded by a black person. That don't come up. They don't bring it back. When the black don't say it, they don't have to say it. Same thing.
And I'm reading here, it says, it's got two, Kaldi, K-A-L-D-I, or Khalid, K-H-A-L-I-D, was a legendary Arab Ethiopian goat herder who discovered the coffee plant around 850, they have C-E. According to the popular legend, after which he was entered to the Islamic world and then to the rest of the world. In the 9th century, the goat herder named Kaldi from Kaffa noticed that when his goats were nibbling on the bright red berries of a certain bush, they became very energetic. Kaldi then chewed on the fruit himself. The exhilaration prompted him to bring the berries to the nearest place of worship in the village. After a brief explanation, the head monk deemed the berries to be the devil's work and leave it up to religion. The head monk, who had thrown them in the fire in the first place, ordered the embers be pulled from the fire and for hot water to be poured over them to preserve the smell. Upon drinking the mixture, they experienced the peaceful, warming, and calming sensation it gave them. The after effects were just as powerful, as they were able to stay alert and discuss important matters for longer periods of time. The monk then shared his discovery with other monks in the monastery, and the knowledge of the energizing berries began to spread. And these berries, I guess, are called coffee beans, I guess?
That's what we call, beans.
Yeah.
Because of the way it grows, yeah. It looks like a bean.
Let's see. All right, so we go back as far as Ethiopia, which is in East Africa. Matter of fact, let me see. Ethiopia. Let's see. Ethiopian coffee. And there's several brands of it.
Remember, that's a high developed country. That's not some backwood Tarzan village.
Right.
Right? That's right. Ethiopia.
Let me see. Let's, Ethiopia, which, it is a deep coffee history in Ethiopia and Somalia. Ethiopia, let's see, Ethiopia, exports. Let's see what that says, brings back. All right, Ethiopia's main exports are gold, which is 21% of their gold. I did not know that. It's 21% of their total export. And coffee is 19% of the exports out of that country. Other exports include live animals, oil seeds, flowers, and hat, what's spelled with. Its main export partner is Switzerland. 21% of its exports gold, are mainly to export gold. All right, we're interested in coffee today, though. Ethiopian.
Remember, this is a merchant culture you're looking at there. And you say that they got this. And just as John Baptiste DeSalvo was a merchant when setting up at the trading post there in the Chicago, or found Chicago. That was
right.
He was a businessman, business minded. There wasn't no job working for the man. He had an idea, and he started. And the rest is history.
Let's see. Now you can buy there. There's at least three brands of Ethiopian, if not six brands. No, there are at least three brands of Ethiopian coffee that you can purchase off of Amazon. So if you're a coffee connoisseur, go to Amazon and put in Ethiopian coffee and see what pops back up. But there's a lot to this because there are coffee barons, coffee plantations. Brazil apparently exports a lot of coffee. And in the United States, I believe there's coffee is grown in Hawaii. Hawaii. That's about it. They say even in Florida, like I'm in Central Florida, so this climate here, soil is not conducive for But they say southern Florida, but I got to find out where in southern Florida because I haven't heard anything produced here. And then the United States Trust Territory of Puerto Rico, they can grow coffee there, but mainland United States there, unless it's something I don't know about, there's no coffee plantations in the United States, the continental United States.
Right.
Okay, now I haven't checked anything in South America, but so we go back as far as Ethiopia. Let's see, coffee history. Let me see what that brings up. Coffee history.
I was going to say, if I can say something about some coffee this morning.
Sure, sure, Chris.
We do have a group here in America called the United Coffee Drinkers of America, and we have made partnerships with Rwanda, which that is a country ran by women, and it's doing well, just so everybody knows. But they went through such a civil war, they lost all their men. The average age of a man, I believe, is 21 in that country. But if you order the coffee from us, and it'll come to your house directly, we do have a roaster here in America, we've got a deal with UPS to deliver the coffee. But we've also got other countries, all the countries over there. But Rwanda is the main one because that was our first. But you got Cameroon that grows coffee. But every time you order this coffee that you're drinking, like if we have it at a coffee shop, our goal is to set up veteran coffee shops all across America at every Army base, every military base, and throughout the cities, and have it veteran run. But every cup of coffee that you drink, 50 cents of that cup of coffee goes back to the country that it was come from to drill for water, so that they don't want, because they're giving you what you want in the morning, so we can all wake up and get our energy, but know that other people are being lifted up at the same time. That would be a good thing. So, you know, people check out United Coffee Drinkers of America. And
okay, United, that's excellent information, Chris. I knew Rwanda had that, you know, when 900,000 or a million people were killed, but I didn't think that it was that there was a shortage of men. But now you're absolutely right, because Rwanda, if you type in Rwanda, right? I just typed in Rwanda coffee, and what came back was Rwanda natural coffee. You can buy that. And then there's Kirkland Signature Rwandan whole beans or whatever. Kirkland Signature Rwandan whole bean dark roast coffee. You can buy that off of Amazon. So, Christopher, what's the name of this organization you talk about? The Coffee Drinkers?
Yeah, that's the United Coffee Drinkers of America.
Okay, United.
Coffee and that's the one you're promoting, right, Chris?
Yes, that's what I'm promoting.
We're not trying to promote Amazon. We're trying to get United Coffee Drinkers of America because the 50 cents goes back to their cause. And water is an issue over there. Right, Chris?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you for that.
And they do have a Facebook page, the United Coffee Drinkers of America. Thank you, Chris, for that. They do have a Facebook page. Now, Chris, tell us more about this United. I knew people took their coffee serious, but not this serious.
Yeah, this is serious.
It's
amazing. Right there, you're going to find out everything about it and how fractionalized that we can make it and actually become the resource that we need. Everybody wakes up to coffee in the morning in America, and they had the Boston Tea Party. So we're launching this out of Boston, and we're calling it the Boston Coffee Party, okay? And it's time for us to realize what it is it takes us to get up and move in the morning so that we can show all these other countries that they're able to move too.
Yeah.
That's the key, right? It's the chain reaction that happens. We've been working on this now for 3 years, and we are ready to launch. People can order their coffee, order it by the month, order it by the year, doesn't matter. And when it shows up, realize you made a difference. Not only have you got the best coffee you can drink, and we've got all the coffees that everybody else has. So if you got Dunkin', if you like Dunkin' Donuts, we got you. If you like Starbucks, we got you. If any place out there that's selling you those cups of coffee for $5, $6, $7, $8, y'all need to pay attention of what you can actually do. Because we're not only going to send money back over to that country, we're going to get our veterans off the street and on the feet. You're going to end homelessness by drinking a cup of coffee. Would you do it? Why not? You're already doing it. Would you be directive and do it in the right way? Stop ordering it from Amazon that way. Let it get delivered to your house. You want it there, we'll deliver it. No problem. Sign up. You know, I went to the American Legion and the VFW National. I was like, look, if you guys bought our coffee, I could get all of our veterans off the street. Y'all got enough posts across the country. Just drink your coffee. If y'all bought my coffee, we could do this. Well, they're in. They're looking at, yes, why not? Why wouldn't we do it? It ain't that we're costing more money for the coffee. It ain't costing you more than what you're already paying, but we're not marketing it, so you're not paying for that. I want word of mouth to be spread, but everybody needs to join that group right there and become the United Coffee Drinkers of America. And now it can move across the world, but right now we got to start. So we're going to start by brewing a great big pot of coffee, and when you take that drink, we're on the brink of ending thirst in that country. It's about doing something for a purpose. You know, you're drinking that coffee for a purpose, to wake up. Well, we need you to wake up without the coffee and realize how woke you are if you paid attention to the things that are going on and you can be part of and not change your life any hardly. If anything,
Chris,
something better than what you already were doing.
Yeah. Chris, I'm reading here where Rwanda's, I'm reading this, but it's not me saying it, I'm reading the word for it. Rwanda's main exports are coffee, tea, and minerals like tin, coltan, wolfram, right? Coffee makes up, now this is for Rwanda, coffee makes up 50 to 80% of Rwanda's total export. Man, that's remarkable.
Yes, sir. And if you don't think that us supporting that export and giving back. Now imagine them getting something back on 50 to 80% of their export that they've never got before because you care.
Yep.
And go.
Well, you got me all. You got one shopper.
Because I'm a coffee connoisseur.
You know what's funny, gentlemen? I don't even drink coffee, but I'm in this, and we've been creating it for, like I said, 3 years. And a friend of mine that I met, he was on it. It was his mission. He had to learn about the coffee business, and he took the lowest producing coffee shop in Boston and turned it into the number one selling coffee shop. In under a month, I believe, under 30 days. But it was because he interacted with his people and found out what it is that interests them that he could do. You know, what was it that, why are they here? They're here just to buy a cup of coffee and keep on walking? If so, he interacted with them, and he would do things. He's a different individual. The one thing about him, he's from Boston, so everything about every other word that he says is an F-bomb, but you have to take it without disrespect. You know what I mean? He's just a very passionate person. But he stepped down and actually let a woman go over this organization and she had just retired and had the largest logistics company in the country or in the world, one or the other. I think the country. So the U.S. here, she had the largest logistics company that she created, and she sold it, and now she's running this, because what is coffee and being shipped everywhere? That's the logistics. So that's how smart he is. You know, he went to somebody that created something to something that needs to be created so that everybody knows that what you're creating by drinking. Because we're going to end how we got to end homelessness. You know, now you got housing. Now you got jobs. We're going to end hunger because we're going to grow food. And people will be shocked that here's the funniest part. I could take one lot in a subdivision, one lot, and I could produce more money on that lot than any house would ever produce. And I would feed everybody in the subdivision. One lot. Because they're all going to pay me to eat. Okay, you're going to go to the store and buy it. You're going to come right down here to this store on the corner and buy it. But I could show you. And if you don't buy it, I'll go down here to the store and sell it to them, and they'll sell it to you, you dumbass. But it's the point. I'm sorry about the cussing. Didn't mean to do that. But it's the point. We need people to pay attention. That every one of these things are out there. And we could talk about them all day long, and you could do something about them also.
Chris, you make the point that the solution is right there in the context of the problem, so to speak. You got to go to a little country somewhere here that goes to the moon is right here on the ground where we are, what the problem is.
Yeah, why leave your subdivision if we could have the kids in your subdivision deliver your food to you?
That makes sense.
You want some fish? I got you. Coming up the street.
Yeah, that makes
you want
sense.
It cleaned? I got a job for somebody. You want your vegetables cut up? I got a job for somebody. You want your salad prepared? I got a job for somebody. That's the difference here, you know, and it's not necessarily a job. It's a purpose. And people, you know, you might think you have a purpose, but I ask this question to every person that's ever met me, and I know, you know, y'all heard it several times. But who are you when no one's around, when you get to create and make a sound? That's your question to anybody listening. That ain't my question. I don't want to hear it. So don't say it to another person, and there's no way you'll worsen. But you need to answer it because you're going to question it. Because you know what? People don't have a clue who they are. They don't know what their abilities are. And it's just time to pick people up. Now, if a cup of coffee does that, if this conversation did that, if any way of something that you're listening to did that, then maybe you found a little joy, right? But if you found joy in drinking coffee, enjoy knowing that somebody over in that country could drink too, could you enjoy it? That's real. It's really happened. Would you enjoy that? But don't answer it to me. Answer it to yourself. But also, when nobody else is influencing you, what is influencing you?
Very good. All right. Well, of course. Yes,
sir. Well, I'm getting educated on coffee, man, some of the largest producers of coffee by country. Let's see, the list I have here, Brazil is number one, Vietnam is number two, Colombia in South America is three, Indonesia is four, Honduras in Central America is five. Ethiopia is number six. India is number seven. Uganda is number eight. Mexico is number nine. Guatemala in Central America is 10. Peru is 11. Nicaragua is 12. China, boy, it's a lot of countries. It's interesting, these Central American countries. Anyway, Let's see, Costa Rica 15, Kenya 16, that's East Africa. Delmar, you've been here. Papua New Guinea ranks number 17 on the planet in coffee production.
Yes, sir.
Tanzania.
I drank a lot of it. One time.
Well, they're ranked number 17 on the planet as far as coffee production goes. El Salvador.
Let me ask you a quick question. Maybe you can find this out.
Right.
In size, what is Papua New Guinea in coffee production?
Man, not very big.
I'm going to open your eyes right quick. I'm going to open your eyes real quick.
Well, give us the answer, Chris.
Oh, I know probably. I'm just telling you, it's probably the smallest.
I mean, a company at the size of the country, I can say it's very small. I can say that. Yeah.
It's small.
Delmar's actually been there. Yeah.
Delmar's been there. Go by the size of the country that's delivering that coffee, and you're going to find out Papua New Guinea is probably number one.
It's a very small country. Yeah.
It's close.
Very small.
I'm looking it up now to see New Guinea.
Yeah, I was just creating in my mind. I had a thought, so I thought I'd share it with everybody and see if we can all get intrigued.
Well, here's important, Chris. You say it's not in a huge, mega country. It's a little small island. Like you say, down out there off the coast out from Sydney, Australia, near here. Yes, sir.
Okay, coffee production in Papua New Guinea. Coffee production in Papua New Guinea is the country's second largest agricultural export after oil palm, or palm oil. It employs 2.5 million people and accounts for approximately 1% of the world production, according to the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development. Let's see. Coffee is the highest foreign exchange earner for Papua New Guinea, the majority of which is grown in the eastern Highland Province, the western Highland Province, and Simbu in Papua New Guinea, with the industry not derived on a colonial plantation-based system. Production is largely by small farmers with land holdings that grow as little as 20 trees per plot in coffee gardens. I never even heard of that term before, a coffee garden. All right. Alongside the subsistence crops, predominantly in isolated places, the product is mostly certified as organic coffee. And they have different types of coffee.
Yeah, I had enough of either one. I drank it for a whole year before I consumed all of it. Yeah, that's a lot of coffee, a lot of different kinds.
You know, they got a whole Wikipedia page on this, detailed, too, on coffee production in Papua New Guinea. Man. Well, I have a whole new respect for coffee. Well, a lot of people, they don't start until they had that first cup.
That's right.
Man, my ex-father-in-law, he started his day that way. Coffee.
I drink three things in the morning. First, water. Second, a little milk. And then third, coffee. Every morning, Lord bless you. That's where it starts.
Yeah, Delmar, you drink yours black or you cream? For me, I need cream and sugar if I drink.
I can do it both ways. Depending on the quality of the coffee. If it's bad coffee, I got to sweeten it up and put some cream in it. But if it's a good, rich quality, I can drink it black. But again, depending upon, because there are some low grade and there's some high grade. And I think Chris mentioned about Arabia. Chris, do you have that in your?
Yeah. I don't even drink coffee, you know. I love the smell of it, though.
My favorite flavor of ice cream is coffee flavored.
Correct. I like cake that's coffee cake.
Oh, love it, love it.
I can do things with coffee. I love coffee that way. You can even put coffee on a steak.
Okay? Yeah.
Just know. And it's something that everybody's starting their day with, but let's make you go to sleep at night thinking about how you're going to start your day again. And that this is the whole reason that we do this movement. And when I went to Texas, we were doing this thing, and the guy was sending me United Coffee Drinkers of America with their race car, you know, being running around the track. And then they had a Hope car running around the track with them, because it's time for humans on planet Earth to start housing our people everywhere, don't you think? You know, I asked that question to AI. And do you know what it told me? I said, if every person on Earth had a home, that's it. How would that change the human race? You know what the hell that thing said? In every way. In every way, the human being would change tomorrow. Now, that's artificial intelligence that's taken all of your intelligence and it's artificially just give it back to me. But it's gave me your thoughts before you had them, but now it's having them for you, but it's telling you. You are as only strong as your weakest link. Realize that. Shane is only you and your family. Guess what? That's not who's going to hurt you. Okay?
Right.
That's not who's going to hurt you. That's not going to who's going to come take what you got so they have something. Okay?
And Chris?
Yes, sir.
From a religion standpoint, if people miss this, the book I live by said that I don't care what you say about God or what you do. If you don't treat humanity right, you can forget it. God said, I don't need you. You can't see me and nothing like that. It's how you treat your fellow man. So like you say, long folk are hungry, homeless, and all that thing. You just religious stuff is just a joke.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I'll tell you what. I don't speak religion to anybody. Nobody's heard me speak religion to you. What I've spoke to you is, I've spoke humanity to you.
That's right. That's what it's all about. That's right.
Okay? So humanity created Christianity. Okay? But I'm going to say, if you believe in the Bible, and you say you're going to do what that book says for you to do, I'm going to give you a little sermon here this morning for a second. Only one book, though. I'm only going to read one book. Isaiah 65:21. Now I'm going to read two. I'm going to read Revelations first. I'm going to go to the end before I bring you the beginning. Are you ready? Without unity, none of it works. Not one word in that book matters.
That's right.
Okay? All right? Not one word. Not one word. Now, unity is you and I together's why. Boy, that wasn't difficult, was it? Come on now. I want you to see. Now, I'm going to bring you to the beginning. And it ain't at the beginning. I'm not talking. Well, I will. I'm going to go for three. I give you all seed and fruit-bearing plants. Okay? I'm going to give you that one. That was in Genesis. Now I'm going to give you one in the middle that is the beginning.
Well,
so
coffee would be one of those.
The beginning. Isaiah 65:21. They will build houses
and live in them.
And grow fruit and eat the fruit, or grow vineyards and eat the fruit.
That could be a coffee plant.
I hope what I said, there's a seed I just let go. Never underestimate the power of planting a seed.
That's what it's about.
Well, I'm interested in coffee seeds now.
That's right. Coffee beans, here we come. Because, and I even got a poem about it. I done one of my spoken words about it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to have to share that one of these days on here just so we can keep people's minds on that coffee, because you're already drinking. You're probably drinking it right now. And if you are, think about how you're going to drink from now on. You have a choice, everybody. Please make your choices. But guess what? Believe We see what you are by your choices. We want people to not be thought that they're not worth nothing. All you worth something, you all have something, and there's no such thing as a disability to me. You have other abilities that are better than mine. So do you have something, even though something's been taken away? How many times has been things you've not had them no more? You know, that's what started this radio show, was a house that this man didn't have control of anymore. And here we are 10 years later talking about coffee and how we can change your life.
Yeah,
how
you're right.
Change others. Someone you'll never meet face to face, but you can give them grace just by you changing what you do, but still do what you're doing. Come on, y'all. It's really that simple. The 7-8-1. Seven people, 8-1. Kill it. I love it. You know, playing with letters and numbers and all these things, because that's what we are. The universe, everything we're talking on is a one and a zero. Everybody needs to pay attention. We're supposed to be paying attention. What are you paying attention to? You know, I love this show because I never really know what his content's going to be. And whenever he started talking and we got off of the inspirationals that y'all need to hear, if you haven't heard them, and if you've heard them 1,000 times, good. That because this show matters to you. It matters to me. I love it. And I like to see what this show is going to bring as it starts to move. I got a call on Sunday asking me if I would do the Superdome next year at the Super Bowl. And that's because I was invited to UNLV at the NFL Players Association on Thursday to build a house. And you got to know, the greed on this planet and the negative is going to stop the need from being helped. And you're all going to be in need. You know, when you look at Amazon and how many people they have laid off, over 100,000. You look at all these big places. You want to know who took your job? AI. They don't need you anymore. So that's the part. Those businesses have got it to where everyone in this country is 90 days away from homelessness. They are taking people's homes because they can't pay for them. And if people do go to get a job, they have to take a pay cut. And they get told they have too much knowledge. They're over-experienced. But the ones that ain't looking for the jobs, that those jobs are for, they're help wanted everywhere.
Right. Well,
sorry, everybody.
No problem at all. Great contribution. I'm trying to find my board here.
Thank you, Chris.
Let's see. All right. Well, Delmar, anything else to add on the coffee?
For the topic. Thank Chris for telling us about United, and we will move on that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
We're probably going to do a part two to the coffee tomorrow, along with we're going to combine building along with coffee tomorrow.
Okay.
But we're going to do a part two on this tomorrow, because I didn't realize it was this in depth.
Oh yeah, no, it's totally written, my friend. We have everything. We're ready to launch, completely launch, and make it so everybody has it. But we need everybody to step up and do something. I mean, it really takes that action. And, you know, I had a meeting last night with the city council. And these people, I turned around, instead of offering them the energy, the investors that I had, they know that there's money in the state that the city can get to put toward these projects. So instead of them putting up 100% of the money, they made me turn around and tell them they got to have an equity stake in this venture. but we're going to sell them their energy between 40 and 50% cheaper than they're paying for it right now. And then we're going to take the profit from that money, and we're going to put up the $2 million back into the communities that we're serving right there. And, you know, they loved it, but that wasn't the only thing that came to the table. I brought solutions. And with this presentation, you can take this, and we can go present it to any city, small, large, doesn't matter. And you guys have it. There is a full package. And it comes from K through college on education. And it comes with nothing but inspiration. It's a positive in every way, but it shows the land we're using in a multiplicity way. And that's what they want to see, dual purpose on land. And if you can turn it into money, then you got it. So figuring out that dual purpose, whatever it might be, it's whatever project you might decide to see. But let's open up people's eyes so that everybody will believe what you see, because we got to put it in their face. And it took – I didn't even know the guy that had offered me to go to New Orleans, but he does a radio show, and I never knew it's a big radio show. And he asked me they want to push and promote the 781 this year all through the Gulf Coast and rebuild Katrina. Are y'all ready?
Yeah.
I think Katrina's ready to be a part of our history, not the mystery of what's it going to be. Let's put it into people's hands, and we'll all see. Peace on earth is in the palm of your hand. Everybody's palm is pink. You show it to me, we'll get it. So let's get it done, guys.
That's true. All right, on that note, thank you, Chris. Thank you, Delmar. We'll be back tomorrow with part two.
All right.